أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful.
Assalamu alaikum. Hello. Welcome to the Sufi Study Circle podcast. I am your host, Bill Whitehouse, and my Sufi friends call me Anab. I have been traveling sometimes more quickly and sometimes much more slowly on the Sufi path for over 40 years. I am not a Sufi sheikh, but I would like to use the contents of this podcast as a means of sharing with you some thoughts, ideas, possibilities, values, and principles concerning the Sufi spiritual way. Each edition of the Sufi Study Circle podcast will feature various selections concerning poetry, essays, readings from traditional sources, and reflections that give expression to different dimensions of the Sufi path. In addition, there also will be several musical interludes included that offer a change of pace of sorts. So relax, melt into the comfort of your chair, close your eyes, and permit me to take you on an excursion through some of the unrestricted regions of the Sufi spiritual path.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful.
فَوَجَدَا عَبْدًا مِنْ عِبَادِنَا آتَيْنَاهُ رَحْمَةً مِنْ عِنْدِنَا وَعَلَّمْنَاهُ مِنْ لَدُنَّا عِلْمًا
Then found they one of our slaves unto whom we had given mercy from us and had taught him knowledge from our presence.
قال له موسى هل أتبعك على أن تعلمني مما علمت رشدا قال إنك لن تستطيع معي صبرا وكيف تصبر على ما لم تحط به خبرا قال ستجدني إن شاء الله صابرا إن شاء الله صابرا ولا أعصي لك أمرا قال فإن اتبعتني فلا تسألني عن شيء حتى
Moses said unto him, May I follow thee to the end that thou mayest teach me right conduct of that which thou hast been taught? He said, Lo, thou canst not bear with me. How canst thou bear with that whereof thou canst not compass any knowledge? He said, Allah willing, thou shalt find me patient, and I shall not in aught gainsay thee. He said, Well, if thou go with me, ask me not concerning aught till I myself mention of it unto thee.
لقد جئت شيئا إمرا قال ألم أقل إنك لن تستطيع معي صبرا قال لا تؤاخذني بما نسيت ولا ترهقني من أمري عسرا فانطلقا حتى إذا لقيا غلاما فقتله قال أقتلت نفسا زكية بغير نفس لقد جئت شيئا نكرا.
So the twain set out till, when they were in the ship, he made a hole therein. Moses said, Hast thou made a hole therein to drown the folk thereof? Thou verily hast done a dreadful thing. He said, Did I not tell thee, thou couldst not bear with me? Moses said, Be not wroth with me that I forgot, and be not hard upon me for my fault. So the twain journeyed on, till when they met a lad, he slew him. Moses said, What, hast thou slain an innocent soul who hath slain no man? Verily thou hast done a horrid thing.
صدق الله العظيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful.
قال ألم أقل لك إنك لن تستطيع معي صبرا قال إن سألتك عن شيء بعدها فلا تصاحبني قد بلغت من لدني عذرا فانطلقا حتى إذا أتيا أهل قرية استطعما أهلها حتى إذا أتيا أهل قرية استطعما أهلها فأبوا أن يضيفوهما فوجدا فيها جدارا يريد أن ينقض فأقامه قال لو شئت لاتخذت عليه أجرا
He said, Did I not tell thee that thou couldst not bear with me? Moses said, If I ask thee after this concerning aught, keep not company with me. Thou hast received an excuse from me. So they twain journeyed on till when they came unto the folk of a certain township. They asked its folk for food, but they refused to make them guests. And they found therein a wall upon the point of falling into ruin, and he repaired it. Moses said, If thou hadst wished, thou couldst have taken payment for it.
قال هذا فراق بيني وبينك سأنبئك بتأويل ما لم تستطع عليه صبرا أما السفينة فكانت لمساكين يعملون في البحر فأردت أن أعيبها وكان وراءهم ملك يأخذ كل سفينة غصبا وأما الغلام فكان أبواه مؤمنين فخشينا أن يرهقهما طغيانا وكفرا فأردنا أن يبدلهما ربهما خيرا منه زكاة وأقرب رحما
He said, This is the parting between thee and me. I will announce unto thee the interpretation of that thou couldst not bear with patience. As for the ship, it belonged to poor people working on the river. And I wished to mar it, for there was a king behind them who was taking every ship by force. And as for the lad, his parents were believers, and we feared lest he should oppress them by rebellion and disbelief. And we intended that their Lord should change him for them, for one better in purity and nearer to mercy.
أما الجدار فكان لغلامين يتيمين في المدينة وكان تحته كنز لهما كنز لهما وكان أبوهما صالحا فأراد ربك أن يبلغا أشدهما ويستخرجا كنزهما رحمة من ربك وما فعلته عن أمري ذلك تأويل ما لم تستع عليه صبرا.
And as for the wall, it belonged to two orphan boys in the city, and there was beneath it a treasure belonging to them, and their father had been righteous, and thy Lord intended that they should come to their full strength and should bring forth their treasure as a mercy from their Lord. And I did it not upon my own command. Such is the interpretation of that wherewith thou couldst not bear.
The foregoing recitation was by Qari Wahid Zafar Kasmi. It is from Surah 18, Al-Kahf, the Cave, verses 65 through 82. In many, if not most, of the first seven editions of the Sufi Study Circle podcast, the recitation of the Quran has been followed by a few brief observations. Such observations are not intended to serve as an interpretation of the Quran, nor are they intended to serve as a commentary concerning the Quran. Rather, when reading or listening to the recitation of the Quran, there often are occasions when certain ideas and thoughts come to mind. I refer to such observations as Quranic resonances. That is, something in the recitation or reading of the Quran resonates with something in me, and the observations that ensue give expression to such resonances. Today's Quranic resonance is as follows. Some people point to the state of the world and seek to use it as an argument against the existence of God, or as an argument against worshipping a being who would permit such a world to exist. They talk about all manner of natural disasters as well as the treacheries of human beings that lead to death, rape, torture, war, and oppression. And they conclude, how could a loving, all-powerful God permit such a suffering to occur? Surely this means that either God does not exist, or if divinity does exist, then God is not a worthy recipient of human adoration. Such people believe they have all the information and understanding they need to make such judgments. Yet, like Musa, may God's peace be upon him, in the previous Quranic recitation, they lack the necessary insight to be able to put the events of life into a proper perspective. In the foregoing Quranic recitation, Musa, peace be upon him, is provided with an explanation for why certain actions were taken by the mysterious servant of divinity. Of course, most of us do not receive an explanation, at least in the present life, as to why we or others have to go through the events that take place in life. As a result, many people come to the conclusion that it all seems so arbitrary, unnecessary, and often cruel. Some individuals, by the grace of God, acquire the patience necessary to endure the phenomena of life without permitting whatever difficulties might be sent their way to undermine their faith in God's love, benevolence, and purpose. Ironically, it is such people who often are the ones who are called upon to undergo the most suffering, pain, and difficulty. This patience is nourished by a trust in divinity concerning what takes place in life, a trust which perseveres through a willingness to accept that pain, suffering, and difficulty are not the result of some arbitrary toying with creation by a sadistic entity, but happenings that would make sense if we were to be given an explanation about what role such dimensions of existence play in God's himmer or aspiration concerning the universe. No human being experiences suffering, pain, or difficulty without God being present to experience such pain as well. It is not possible for any aspect of creation to experience suffering and pain without God also experiencing that same degree of suffering. We do not understand the significance, meaning, or value of suffering. We only know that we don't like it when it happens to us, our loved ones, or to other human beings and facets of creation. Like a physician who causes pain in order to bring about healing, so too, Divinity exposes human beings to pain and suffering so that in the end we might become healed in essential ways. Such pain is not only a trial for those who experience it, but as well the existence of pain is a trial for anyone who witnesses it and is faced with the decision of what to do when confronted with pain and suffering, especially when, like Musa, peace be upon him, we do not understand what is taking place. Today's edition of Friday Thoughts is entitled, The Faith Instinct. In 2009, Nicholas Wade released his book, The Faith Instinct, How Religion Evolved and Why It Endures. Wade is a science writer who, in addition to having written half a dozen books, also has worked for the New York Times and, in addition, was at one point a deputy editor for the English science magazine Nature, as well as was a member of the news staff for the U.S. magazine Science. In the aforementioned book, Wade explores what he considers to be both the weaknesses and strengths of religious activity. He especially wishes to account for why, despite whatever weaknesses it entails, religion continues to endure. Before delving into various aspects of the perspective being outlined by Wade in his foregoing book, it might be instructive to take a look at some of the meanings to which religion supposedly gives etymological expression. Words are ways of linguistically parsing the universe, and therefore it is important to understand the structural character of the logic that is inherent in different ways of engaging and parsing experience. Various individuals claim that the etymology of religion rests with the Latin word religare. The central sense of the foregoing Latin word refers to a process of tying or binding. The obvious questions are, what is being tied and what is the nature of the tying process? The foregoing questions might be best engaged through another Latin word, religionem, which conveys a sense of reverence for that which is considered sacred. When combined together, the foregoing two etymological possibilities give expression to the idea of becoming bound or tied to that for which one has reverence or that which one considers to be sacred. At the heart of this condition of being tied or bound is a state of belief, understanding, commitment, knowledge, and or faith concerning one's relationship with that which is considered to be sacred or worthy of reverence. Another possibility involves the term religion, which comes from the Old French and refers to a process of devotion or piety, as well as refers to communities in which such devotion and piety plays a central role. Devotion and piety both give expression to a sense of being bound or tied to that which is sacred or worthy of reverence, but as well piety alludes to a set of behaviors, some of which are moral in nature, that are intended to manifest conscientiousness concerning the presence of the realm of the sacred. When discussing the meaning of religion, some individuals make reference to Cicero's use of the term religare. This term refers to a process of going through a text or a textual reading more than once. Perhaps the idea of reading something again is intended to make reference to a process of taking care with and critically reflecting on the possible meanings inherent in a text. In other words, one goes through a reading again in order to make sure that one understands what is being said, in order to try to be certain that one has arrived at the truth of a given text. The foregoing sense of things might be relevant in contexts in which the texts being studied have to do with issues considered to be sacred in nature. One wants to bind oneself or tie oneself to the truths that are being given expression through various sacred themes contained in a given text, and one does not want to become bound or tied to some distorted understanding concerning such matters. There is a need to exercise care in how one reads a given text or parses a given experience. One engages the material again and again to work towards a correct understanding of what is being said. The Oxford English Dictionary indicates there are some question marks surrounding the etymology of the word religion. However, one should keep in mind that etymological factors have to do with how certain root ideas associated with this or that word were used in the past and in the process shaped the way in which language was used to parse experience. Nonetheless, while etymology can help create a sense of some of the possible meanings that might be woven into the semantic and syntactic fabric of a word, the fact of the matter is that words tend to evolve over time. As this occurs, words become used in a variety of ways that often juxtapose, if not blend, older senses of a word with newer nuances, leading to different understandings and ways of describing experience. Today, there are a growing number of people who are of the opinion that the general idea of quote-unquote religion has acquired what they consider to be a deserved aura of negative connotations, if not problematic denotations. Such individuals seem to believe there is something inherently defective in the process of binding or tying oneself to a sense of the sacred in a manner that establishes parameters of piety and moral behavior for purposes of engaging the sacred in an appropriately reverential manner. An obvious question that arises in conjunction with the foregoing considerations is what, if anything, is the relationship between, quote, the sacred, end of quote, and, quote, the nature of reality, end of quote. Does that which is considered sacred necessarily give expression to some dimension of the real, or is the notion of sacredness merely a human construction? If there are dimensions of reality that are worthy of reverence and thereby give expression to the sacred, then identifying the actual nature of such dimensions becomes a very important process. If one reads or parses reality in the wrong way, then one's sense of the sacred will be skewed. Consequently, one must be careful to distinguish between, on the one hand, what, if anything, reality actually requires of us, and on the other hand, what, if anything, we are imposing on reality inappropriately. If there is a sacred dimension to reality, then binding or tying oneself to that dimension in a manner that distorts the nature of such a reality is likely, sooner or later, to lead to problems of one kind or another, both for oneself as well as for others. Perhaps Cicero was on to something when he mentioned the idea of going through the reading of a text or reality more than once. Binding oneself to the sacred should be done in accordance with the nature of the sacredness to which reality actually gives expression, to the extent that it does this, rather than in accordance with some human construction that is arbitrarily imposed on reality. In many ways, the general idea of religion might carry a lot of negative connotations for so many people, precisely because all too many individuals have done such a poor job of reading reality, understanding its dimensions of sacredness, and determining what, if anything, such sacredness requires from us. In and of itself, the idea of binding oneself to the sacred and developing a sense of reverence in that regard is not necessarily the problem, because everyone binds himself or herself to a hermeneutical orientation or set of beliefs that they consider to be sacred and deserving of reverence, and therefore commitment, but rather, the issue is what, if anything, does one's sense of the sacred have to do with the actual nature of reality? Nicholas Wade, the author of the aforementioned book, The Faith Instinct, How Religion Evolved and Why It Endures, believes that religious behavior can be studied quite independently of the issue of whether or not God exists. Surely, however, unless one wishes to reduce religion down to just an arbitrary philosophical exercise, and of course there are those who wish to proceed in precisely this fashion, then removing the issue of God's existence from the realm of religion tends to ignore the possibility that religion constitutes a process of exploring experience for the purpose of establishing the truth concerning the nature of reality. And if one is disinterested in whether or not God exists, then one is blind to various possibilities concerning the nature of the relationship that might exist between religion and reality, and whether or not religion is reality-based or delusional in nature. At its heart, religion gives expression to a search for the truth concerning one's relationship with being. Sacredness has to do with one's understanding concerning the nature of that relationship. By binding or tying oneself to a given sense of the sacred, one is attempting to commit oneself to understanding and engaging reality in a certain way. The question then becomes a matter of the quality of one's search for the truth, and whether or not one's search has correctly uncovered, in part or in whole, the presence of sacredness in reality, and what such a presence entails with respect to human behavior. Wade defines religion as, quote, a system of emotionally binding beliefs and practices in which a society implicitly negotiates through prayer and sacrifice with supernatural agents, securing from them commands that compel members through fear of divine punishment to subordinate their interests to the common good, end of quote. The foregoing definition raises a number of questions. For example, how and why does a given belief or practice become emotionally binding? Does one become emotionally committed to a belief or practice because it reflects some sort of truth concerning the nature of reality? Or is the emotional commitment due to various needs within an individual that have little or nothing to do with the nature of reality independent of the individual? Is religion primarily a social or group activity? Or is religion an individual pursuit that can be co-opted by various social influences? Is religion really just a matter of negotiating with supernatural agents via prayer and sacrifice? Or is religion a process of seeking the truth concerning the nature of reality and one's relationship with such reality? Is prayer a process of negotiating with the supernatural realm? Or could prayer be a process of remembering, praising, and making contact with that which makes reality possible? Is prayer a means to an end, or is it an end in itself? If sacrifice is necessary, then what is the nature and purpose of such sacrifice? Isn't undergoing personal sacrifice for the sake of discovering the truth one of the most important forms of religious sacrifice? Should religion be about rewards and punishments? Isn't discovering some aspect of the truth its own reward? And isn't missing out on or becoming closed to the truth its own form of punishment? How can one define the common good in terms other than those that have to do with establishing the truth of things? Why should one subordinate one's search for the truth to potentially arbitrary conceptions of what constitutes the common good? Who gets to determine what the common good is? What justifies such determinations? Nicholas Wade indicates in his book that religion has been described as a means for acquiring personal rewards, or a system for creating circles of trust, or a way of binding people together for purposes of collective action, as well as a framework for moral rules through which to organize and regulate society. Irrespective of the uses to which some people or communities have put religion, if religion is considered independently of its capacity to seek the truth, then don't the foregoing uses become suspect? For example, what is the point of using religion to rally collective action if such actions are not rooted in the truth? If one divorces the process of rallying collective action from the truth, then doesn't such a process become little more than arbitrary exercises in propaganda, manipulation, and control? What good is achieved by creating a system of moral rules that do not reflect the truth of things? Will circles of trust long survive in the absence of truth? One can come up with any number of utilitarian and social uses for religion. However, if the only use of religion that matters is its capacity to assist an individual or a group of individuals to seek the truth concerning the nature of reality, then what is the value of any usage of religion that ignores its role in seeking the truth concerning existence? When one says that religion has a dark side, is it really religion that has the dark side, or are the human uses to which religion is put the dark side of things? Isn't the so-called dark side of religion really just an indication of how far people have pushed religion away from its role as a methodological means for searching for the truth of one's essential relationship with being? Wade claims that, quote, biological drives for all functions essential to survival are embedded in the human brain. It need surely be no scandal to people of faith that an instinct for religious behavior is one of those necessities. That the mind has been prepared by evolution to believe in gods neither proves nor disproves their existence. End of quote. Wade does not demonstrate, nor does any evolutionary biologist provide the details for, how such biological drives came into existence or how they became embedded in the brain. Wade is assuming that mind and brain are one and the same, but he puts forth no proof to demonstrate the alleged truth of his claim. He assumes that religion is a product of evolution and that religion is merely one among many biological drives that have become embedded in the brain, but he doesn't reveal the precise nature of such an evolutionary process. For instance, Wade doesn't account for how the evolutionary changes came about that supposedly prepared the human mind to believe in gods. In other words, he doesn't account for the origins of intellect, consciousness, logic, language, imagination, emotion, insight, understanding, or how any of this led to the emergence of religion. Wade argues that, quote, an instinct for religious behavior is an evolved part of human nature. Because of the decided survival advantage conferred on people who practice religion, the behavior has become written into our neural circuits by at least 50,000 years ago, and probably much earlier. End of quote. Even if one agreed with Wade that the practice of religion gives expression to a survival advantage of some kind, this doesn't account for how such practices came into being in the first place. Moreover, I have more than a few questions about the precise nature of the quote-unquote survival advantage that is supposedly conferred by those sorts of practices. One might conjecture that as many people died, if not more, practicing such behaviors as survived. So what is the proof that such practices conferred survival advantage? Every group has an array of practices, so how does one show that any given set of practices, for example religious ones, provided a survival advantage for one group relative to the beliefs and practices of some other group. All belief systems offer emotionally binding elements that could lead to collective action of a concerted sort and provide ritualistic ways of trying to control the events of life. So how does one show that religion, per se, provided some sort of a survival advantage rather than techniques for waging war and or securing food and or providing shelter and or dealing with power issues and or caring for the young? According to Wade, quote, "Like language, religion is a complex cultural behavior built on top of a genetically shaped learning machine. Culture supplies the content of what is learned," end of quote. Wade does not adequately explain how the contents of what is learned came into being, nor does he account for how the capacity to generate such contents originated. Furthermore, while culture might provide a great deal of the content for many religious frameworks, religion does not necessarily give expression to only complex cultural behavior, nor does religion necessarily constitute behavior that is rooted in a, quote, genetically shaped learning machine, end of quote. This is especially the case when religion is an individual activity that occurs in the midst of, and oftentimes in opposition to, cultural influences, and if understanding is a function of processes that might be shaped by the genes that regulate brain activity, but cannot be reduced to the activity of those genes. No one has shown that phenomenology is a strict function of genetic or biological activity. No one has shown that this or that gene working in conjunction with other such genes is causally responsible for the consciousness, language, reasoning, understanding, creativity, imagination, or morality that is given expression through human phenomenology. While biology might help to frame and shape the process of learning, learning, insight, understanding, and so on might not be strict functions of biology or genetics. Indeed, until we understand the essential nature of consciousness, intelligence, reason, language, insight, intuition, imagination, and so on, it is entirely possible that there are extra-biological and extra-genetic dimensions underlying the process of learning and understanding. Furthermore, individuals do not always necessarily submit to a given culture's representation of religion. People ask questions in such contexts. People critically reflect on what they are being told. People often rebel against or disregard such cultural influences. People who are not satisfied with the religious answers that are given by cultural leaders and institutions often go in search of truths beyond the parameters of what a given culture offers in the way of religious content. Unfortunately, pursuing the truth does not always constitute a survival advantage. Power structures, institutions, educators, and cultural leaders often seek to resist, oppress, or eliminate those who go against the cultural flow, and therefore, while institutional religion might offer a survival advantage to those who submit to such institutions, survival in and of itself does not necessarily have anything to do with the truth or seeking the truth. In his book, Wade claims that, quote, "As with language, religion is most significant as a social behavior. One can speak or pray to oneself, but both are most meaningful when done in company," end of quote. Praying to God or seeking God is not necessarily a social activity, although both can be done in a social context. People can only pursue God, reality, and truth through their own phenomenological experiences, and while social influence can modulate such phenomenology, it is the individual's experience and understanding of that experience that is the medium through which reality and divinity are engaged. Prayer and seeking God are most meaningful when done in conjunction with discovering the truth about the nature of reality. This is the case irrespective of whether this is done individually and/or socially. While developing his theoretical perspective concerning the similarities between the development of language and the development of religion, Wade states, quote, "It is easy enough to see why natural selection would have favored genes underlying the faculty of language, given the immense advantage to members of a social species of being able to share those thoughts and information," end of quote. In this regard, Wade notes that, quote, The first genes affecting language have started to come to light, beginning with the discovery in 2001 of the FOXP2 gene, which affects several neural and muscular skills underlying the articulation of speech. End of quote. Whatever the role of the FOXP2 gene might be with respect to making language possible, none of this explains how such a gene came into being in the first place. It is not enough to say that a given gene confers this or that sort of survival advantage. One must be able to explain how such genes came to be, and if one can't do this, then the absence of such data constitutes an important source of lacunae in the theoretical fabric being spun by people like Wade. Being able to understand what value something might have once it has arisen says absolutely nothing at all about how that something came into being in the first place. Explaining, possibly, something after the fact is not nearly as impressive as being able to explain the origins of that same something before the fact of hypothesizing about whatever value or advantage such a development supposedly has. Wade continues along the foregoing lines and asks, quote, why should religious behavior have evolved? What benefit does religion confer other than spiritual fulfillment? How can religious behavior make a difference on the only scale measured by natural selection, that of leaving more progeny? End of quote. Once again, Wade is asking the wrong questions. As is the case with language, the foregoing author needs to ask how the capacity for religion arose in the first place. How did the capacity to search for meaningfulness, purpose, identity, and truth come into being? Moreover, contrary to Wade's foregoing remark, people do not always find spiritual fulfillment through religion. There are many obstacles standing in the way of such fulfillment, and as a result, people need to develop character traits of patience, perseverance, courage, humility, and so on, to endure the dark night of the soul that tends to prevail prior to the point, if it occurs at all, when spiritual realization and fulfillment come into the picture. Furthermore, irrespective of whatever social or evolutionary benefit Wade believes might be conferred by religious behavior, the purpose of religious activity need not be about conferring either social or evolutionary benefit. Leaving more progeny is not necessarily the measuring scale that should be used to assess the value of religion. The foregoing sort of measure is skewed by the assumptions underlying evolutionary theory. Such a measure presupposes that social benefit and evolutionary advantage are the only things that matter in conjunction with the issue of religious activity. If religion is an individual search for the truth concerning the nature of sacredness, then measures involving social benefit and evolutionary advantage are secondary to, if not irrelevant for, such a search. If religion involves an array of problems that face an individual when she or he attempts to bind himself or herself to such a search, then whether or not an individual succeeds or fails with respect to solving such problems might or might not carry any sort of social benefit or evolutionary advantage. In his book, Wade argues that, quote, the practice of religion is heavily social, end of quote, that its, quote, religious services and rituals are communal. A religion belongs to a community and shapes members' social behavior both towards one another, the in-group, and towards non-believers, the out-group, end of quote. If a religion does not permit individuals to find the truth concerning the nature of reality as well as discover the nature of one's relationship with such reality, then whatever sense of community religion provides and whatever evolutionary value it might confer, such accomplishments constitute little more than Pyrrhic victories. The victories are Pyrrhic because truth has been sacrificed on the altar of social cohesion. If one leaves progeny who have lost the desire for seeking truth and merely wish to perpetuate themselves and their cultural institutions, then however long-lived such a society might be, the soul of life, that is, the search for truth, has been lost, and consequently the value of survival in and of itself becomes questionable. There are more ways to assess life than through the limited scales of evolutionary and sociological theory. Wade maintains that, quote, practical morality is not universal. Compassion and forgiveness are the behaviors owed to one's in-group but not necessarily to an outgroup and certainly not to an enemy. End of quote. What is the nature of the proof that supposedly demonstrates that the only group that is owed being treated with compassion and forgiveness is the in-group? Perhaps there is no in-group or out-group when it comes to morality. Perhaps all human beings are owed an array of cares of duty and evolutionary advantage, be damned. Any morality that is divorced from the truth is not practical. Sooner or later, such a morality will always lead one away from adequately resolving social problems. Furthermore, where does the capacity for morality come from? What makes it possible? Shouldn't one understand the origins of the capacity for morality before one begins to say what it can and can't be? Wade's distinction between practical and universal morality seems quite arbitrary. It is a distinction that appears to be largely driven by the requirements of evolutionary theory, rather than being a function of evidential considerations that have been derived independently of such theoretical requirements. Emil Durkheim, one of the founders of sociology, argues in his book, The Elementary Forms of Religious Life, that, quote, "The faithful are not mistaken when they believe in the existence of a moral power to which they are subject and from which they receive what is best in themselves. That power exists, and it is society." End of quote. Durkheim ignores or discounts the possibility that the moral power in which at least some of the faithful believe might transcend society. He seems to overlook the possibility that some sort of moral power is being given expression through reality quite independently of society. Moreover, Durkheim is being fairly arbitrary when he claims that the best of what can be received comes from society. Society did not generate consciousness, language, intelligence, reason, creativity, talent, or the capacity for morality. Rather, society is made possible because its survival is predicated on, among other things, the existence of such capabilities. Society might have a role to play as a catalytic agent that helps consciousness, language, intelligence, reason, creativity, talent, and the capacity for morality to develop. But the best that we receive through such activities comes from the source of such capabilities. Such a source is not society, but rather a function of the nature of reality that transcends society and existed before societies came into being. Durkheim defines religion in the following way, quote, "A religion is a unified system of beliefs and practices relative to sacred things, that is, things set apart and forbidden, beliefs and practices which unite into one single moral community called the Church, all those who adhere to them." End of quote. Again, what is the origin of the foregoing beliefs and practices? Are they man-made or are they extra-human in origin? What is the nature of the origins of one's sense of sacredness? Is it merely a function of indoctrination and the social construction of reality, or is it a function of a resonance of some kind between something within human beings and the nature of reality? And if the latter is the case, then what is the structural character of that resonance? Should one agree with Durkheim that the sacred is something that is set apart and forbidden by a set of social beliefs and practices? Or is the sacred a reflection of something fundamental concerning the nature of reality, independent of those beliefs and practices? Isn't sacredness something to which all of existence gives expression to varying degrees? Aren't the capabilities inherent in human beings all relevant to the issue of sacredness, and whether the nature of such sacredness will be shown to be inherent in reality or merely a delusional imposition? Is Durkheim right when he claims that beliefs and practices become fully united into a single moral community called a church or temple, synagogue, circle, mosque, meeting hall, etc.? Or will there always be expressions of disagreement, discord, disharmony, and difference that are sprinkled throughout society? If the latter is not the case, then how does one account for the rise of differences over the course of history with respect to any given community? Is religion only a powerful way of inducing individuals to sacrifice their sense of self-interest to the interests of the group? Are the interests of the group necessarily different from those of the individual? Isn't it possible that what is in the best interest of the individual is in the best interest of the community or society, and vice versa. What determines what is in the best interest of the individual or society? Wade says that, quote, "Religious knowledge is not like knowing the day of the week. It is something a person feels and is deeply committed to," end of quote. While a person can have knowledge of his or her own religious phenomenology, such knowledge does not necessarily give expression to the truth concerning the nature of reality. The fact that someone is deeply committed to something he or she feels does not necessarily give expression to any truth other than that it is the way the person feels or gives expression to an individual's sense of commitment. The knowledge to which the mystics allude transcends the foregoing sorts of feelings and commitments. Although one might become committed to such transcendent truths and believe one feels them deeply, the presence of commitment and deep feelings in and of themselves does not guarantee that one is committed to the truth or that one actually feels the presence of truth. There is a difference between having knowledge concerning some aspect of reality and having a deeply felt commitment with respect to this or that opinion. In his book, Wade claims that, quote, "Morality is older than religion. Its roots can be seen in monkeys and apes, and religious behavior was engrafted on top of it in the human lineage alone," end of quote. What Wade doesn't explain is how the capacity for rudimentary morality originated in monkeys or in other species of life. Nor does he account for how the capacity for religion became engrafted on top of such moral capabilities. Much of what is said in Nicholas Wade's book, The Faith Instinct, is based on assumptions that are far from being either credible or plausible. And then he puts forth explanations that are a function of various kinds of conceptual retrofits involving such assumptions. Human beings supposedly emerged out of Africa some 50,000 years ago. They were mostly hunter-gatherers. It wasn't until about 15,000 years ago that permanent settlements came into being. Moreover, supposedly by this time, religion had become an important dimension of lived life. By analyzing DNA of living people, Wade believes that one can separate those groups that have been relatively isolated from groups that display a shared genetic pool. Wade assumes that such isolated groups might provide insights into the nature of the religious practices of ancestral populations. I think the foregoing method is of questionable value. Such an approach assumes that the value, understanding, purpose, intention, meaning, and so on associated with such practices have remained the same across time. He is ignoring the possibility that such practices might have become corrupted over time, such that although the form remains, the essence might have long since disappeared, and in the process, the intentions and understandings that led to such practices have become lost in the mist of time, leaving individuals like Nicholas Wade to arbitrarily speculate about what actually went on among such ancient peoples. Even if one could find X number of such, quote, primitive, end of quote, groups today, this proves nothing about the actual origins of religion tens of thousands of years ago, and proves nothing about whether or not such, quote unquote, modern groups represent an accurate picture of group life tens of thousands of years ago, or whether such modern groups constitute a devolution of belief systems that began with people seeking the truth about their relationship with being, and over time the original purpose was corrupted into a system of rules, practices, beliefs, and values that took on more of a role that was rooted in wielding social power for purposes of control, and in the process left the search for truth far behind. The search for truth is a long and difficult process, and therefore perhaps some people in the distant past became frustrated and impatient with the demands of such a search, and as a result began to fashion religion into being something with social, institutional, and ritualistic dimensions that were quite independent of considerations concerning the nature of reality. Such activities gave expression to theologies, that is, theories about religion, rather than the activities associated with the search for the sacred dimension of reality. Such activities became ensconced in belief systems that were focused on social control and uses of power associated with such control, rather than being a methodology for seeking the truth. From the Sufi perspective, the highest form of self-interest is found through a search for the truth about one's relationship with being via a methodology rooted in character. This is also the best coping strategy, and as well, this is the way through which one is opened up to the dimensions of wisdom, such as love, that transcend both methodology and character. From deep within the mysteries of the ancient rainforests along the Amazon River Basin, you are listening to the Sufi Studies Circle podcast. The following poem is from the Mathnawi of Maulana Jalaluddin Muhammad Rumi, as translated by Rafiq Abdullah, and which appears in his book, The Words of Paradise. We speak of God who is hidden, describing the indescribable. You philosophize, I only criticize. Another refutes us both. Yet another, there are always others, will pontificate and vilify and pin truth down like a dead butterfly. Everyone prognosticates and assassinates with a knowing word, a nod, a distance-seeking look. Each insinuates, even to himself, that he knows. All these busy, mouthing truths cannot speak the hidden truth, yet each carries in itself an antidote for its being, as blindness contains insight, as a fleeting moment unveils eternity. Be patient with your counterfeit truths. Like false coins to the real is their value to be measured. So like God's word in the book, we learn to discriminate. All is not true, nor all entirely false. As a small dose of poison a potent medicine makes, so our partial errors, our thirst for impartial good, do slake. When I served as chairperson of the Sufi Study Circle more than 25 years ago, in relation to the meetings that were held at the University of Toronto's International Student Center near the corner of St. George and College Street, the gatherings featured relatively brief readings from the Sufi literature, both ancient and modern. Such readings were intended to serve as a source of information, as well as constituting stimuli for subsequent meditation and critical reflection. Sometimes such readings would lead to an ensuing discussion, and sometimes they were followed by an extended silence as individuals sought to digest what had been said in a given reading. Although the nature of the present podcast format is such that it is not interactive in the way the real-world version of the Sufi Study Circle was many years ago, nonetheless, some of the flavor of the original meetings can be conveyed by providing a weekly excerpt from one or another great Sufi teacher of the past. The perspective that was expressed in the introduction to the previous section featuring great Sufi poets remains in effect in this portion of the Sufi Study Circle. In other words, do not take the prose passages that are stated in the following excerpt from the Sufi literature as being authoritative because this or that Sufi sheikh or spiritual guide said it. Listen to the following passage from an orientation that is prepared to undertake the struggle that is necessary to try to follow the words back to their nonverbal origins. The words of the Sufi teachers are surface indicators of a journey that is largely nonverbal. Those words are intended to serve as visible signposts of sorts that point in the direction of a seemingly contradictory state of affairs that ultimately the nature of truth transcends all possibility of verbal communication and as such is ineffable and shrouded in mystery. This does not mean that one can make truth anything one likes. Irrespective of whether or not we grasp how the universe operates on any or all of its metaphysical levels, the truth concerning such operations does exist. Reality does have a determinate nature. The Sufi guides have always been very clear that the journey to the truth can never be completed without appropriate and informed assistance. Nonetheless, one can at least begin a portion of the spiritual journey by reflecting on what has been said by travelers of the Sufi mystical path. This week's edition of Traditional Readings is from the 9th chapter of The Path of God's Bondsman by Najm al-Din Razi, as translated by Hamid Elgar. The title of the chapter is Concerning the Need for a Sheikh in One's Training and Wayfaring. God Almighty said, quote, Moses said unto him, Shall I follow thee, that thou might teach me the right guidance taught unto thee? End of quote, and this is from the Quran. The Prophet, upon whom be peace and blessings, said, quote, The Sheikh among his following is like the Prophet among his people. End of quote. Know that in order to travel the path of religion and reach the realm of certainty, a perfect sheikh and guide, well acquainted with the way and possessed of sainthood and spiritual efficacy, is essential. Quote, Better to abstain from all but wine, and better for that to come from the hands of a hidden idol. End of quote. Quote, My saints are beneath my domes, none knows them but I. End of quote. And this is a hadith Qudsi. Despite his perfection of rank as a prophet and of degree as a messenger, and despite his being a possessor of firm resolve, Moses, upon whom be peace, had to serve Soyeb continuously for 10 years until he was fit to receive the honor of conversing with God. Then, after attaining the good fortune of being God's interlocutor and the auspiciousness of, quote, We inscribe for him on the tablets the lesson to be drawn from all things and the detailed explanation of all things. End of quote. And this is a hadith Qudsi. After gaining the leadership of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel and receiving the entirety of the Torah from the dictation of the Divine Presence, after all this, in the school for the learning of innate knowledge, he had to request the alphabet of following from the teacher Kizr. Quote, Shall I follow thee, that thou might teach me the right guidance taught unto thee? End of quote, and this is from the Quran. And then the teacher wrote the first inscription on his alphabet slate, quote, Thou wilt not be able to keep patience with me. End of quote, and this is from the Quran. For see in reality, quote, A banquet where 2,000 souls are sacrificed is no place for a loud, empty drummer. End of quote. Seduced, deceived, and outwitted on this path is he who imagines himself able to traverse the limitless desert and attain the Kaaba of union with the strength of his mere human footsteps without guide or escort. Quote, Far, far off is that which ye are promised. End of quote. And this is from the Quran. In the beginning of guidance, it is true there is no need for prophet or sheikh, for that beginning comes with the seed of search that is planted in men's hearts only by the effects of the gaze of God's grace. However much the prophet, upon whom be peace, tried to sow that seed in the soil of Abu Talib's heart, he was unable to do so without God. It was said to him, quote, Verily thou dost not guide whom thou wish, but God guides whomsoever he wills. End of quote, and that is from the Quran. Quote, By God, none has any share of God unless it be through God. End of quote, and this is from a line of poetry from Sanai. Once the seed has appeared, however, there arises the need for prophets and sheikhs to nurture it. Quote, Truly thou guidest to a straight path. End of quote, and this is from the Quran. Know that the need of the wayfaring murid for the sheikh who has attained union is on account of many reasons. First, the outer path to the material Kaaba cannot be traveled without a guide acquainted with the journey, although the traveler on that path has an eye with which to see it and a foot with which to walk on it. The path, moreover, is visible and the distance is fixed. But on the path of the truth, which has been trod by 120,000 and more manifestations of prophethood and instances of messengerhood, not a single footprint is to be seen. Quote, "'Tis with aspiration and vision that the people of his path travel, hence not a single footprint is seen on love's highway." End of quote. Now the novitiate wayfarer on this path has neither vision nor foot to carry him forward. Although initially all were brought forth from the gate of extreme oppressiveness and extreme ignorance, so that none might boast of vision and knowledge concerning the path, it was said to the master of creation, quote, "Thou knewest not what was the book, nor faith, but we made it a light guiding those of our bondsmen whom we will," end of quote. And this is from the Quran. Still, it is certain that so vast a desert cannot be traveled without a vision-bestowing guide. The second reason is that just as on the outward path robbers and bandits are numerous, so that an escort is called for, so too on the path of truth, the adornments of this world, the soul, capricious desire, evil companions and demons, all those are as bandits, and one cannot travel unless escorted by a possessor of sainthood. The third reason is that on this path there are also numerous pitfalls, afflictions, and illusions, in countless deep abysses. Hence the philosophers, through their insistence on traveling alone, have fallen into many an awesome chasm and lost faith and religion. So too the materialists and the naturalists, the Brahmins and the anthropomorphists, and abstractionists and the antinomians, and people of capricious desire and innovation, all belong to those who have embarked on this path without a shake, an exemplary model. They were unable to cross the abysses and pitfalls. Each one fell from the path into some valley of doubt and misfortune and perished there. Quote, "Thou art like an ant, and the path is like the tress of an idol. So go not forth in blind aping and guessing. Beware." End of quote. But those fortunate ones who have traveled under the protection of the sainthood of perfect sheikhs have comprehended the essence of all afflictions and pitfalls, contemplated all illusions with equanimity, and distinguished and recognized the pitfall by means of which each group of the people of capricious desire and innovation have been borne off to hell. Taking refuge themselves in the good fortune of the possessors of sainthood, they have crossed safely over all pitfalls. The fourth reason is that among the different trials and afflictions that beset the path from end to end are the numerous halts and pauses that occur. A sheikh endowed with spiritual efficacy is needed so that by the effect of his sainthood he may deliver the murid from the halts and pauses, restore the ardor of search and the sincerity of desire within him, through various subtle stratagems expel contraction, weariness, and depression from his nature, and with both clear expression and indication awaken the impulse of longing in his inner being. Quote, "Remind, for verily the reminder benefits the believers," end of quote, and this is from the Quran. The fifth reason is that sickness and ailments assail the disposition of the wayfarer on this path. Certain corrupt substances gain dominance over it so that the temperament of search and aspiration becomes perverted. The need then arises for a skillful physician who, with appropriate treatment, will strive to remove the disease and allay the corrupt substance. If this is not done, the wayfarer will be unable to proceed. Indeed, it can be said that these afflictions beset every murid at the outset, and unless the physician of hearts removes them with wholesome medicines, the murid will have no power to begin his journeying on the path. When he is visited again later by the same afflictions and sicknesses or by some of them, he will again need the sheikh as his skilled physician. Otherwise, like other wayfarers, he will remain at a certain station and be infected by some affliction that may damage his faith, just as at each stage and station of this path, thousands upon thousands of sincere and faithful devotees have been severed from all further progress, been infected with various diseases, and lost their faith. The sixth reason is that the wayfarer on this path will reach certain spiritual stations where his spirit is divested of the garment of fleshly humanity and the clothing of water and clay. A ray from the manifestation of the traces of God's attributes will touch it, and it will in turn manifest itself to him with all the spiritual and infinite lights and attributes. The traces and remnants of the falsehood that is fleshly humanity will vanish, and the sense of the verse, quote, "Truth has come and falsehood has vanished," end of quote, and this is from the Quran, will become apparent. At this station, when the mirror of the heart has become purified, it receives the reflection of the manifestation of the Spirit. It experiences the taste of, quote, "I am the truth," end of quote, and, quote, "Glory be unto me," end of quote. And there appears in it the proud delusion that it has found perfection and attained the true goal. The gaze of the intellect, the understanding, and the imagination is totally unable to perceive that any of the prophets and saints has gone beyond this station. Were not the workings of the sainthood of the Sheikh, this being a form of God's favor, to come to the aid of the murid on the edge of this abyss, his faith would be in danger of destruction. For at this station, the danger of belief in incarnation and absorption is to be feared. Therefore, a perfect Sheikh, one well-versed in visionary experiences, is needed to deliver him from this delusion by the workings of his sainthood. He will explain to him the nature of his station, bring to his attention the stations that lie above it, and encourage him to strive towards them. Then the murid will escape this pitfall and set his face to the path once again. Otherwise, he would be so fettered to this obstacle that he could be in no way able to escape. And God is the most knowing. The seventh reason is that various phenomena from the unseen world appear to the wayfarer on the path, and certain visions are unfolded to him. Each of these is either an indication from the unseen world of the murid's deficiencies and excesses, of his progress and pauses, a sign of the purity and impurity of his heart, a pointer to the reprehensible and praiseworthy attributes of his soul, or a mark of veils pertaining to this world and the hereafter of states deriving from Satan, the soul, or God, as well as other matters which cannot be counted or enumerated. The novice has no awareness or knowledge of any of this, for it is all spoken in the language of the unseen, and only the people of the unseen know the language of the unseen. A sheikh is therefore needed, strengthened with divine support, and instructed in the science of interpreting the unseen. Thus did Joseph, upon whom be peace, say, quote, "O Lord, thou hast bestowed kingship upon me and taught me the interpretation of sayings," end of quote, and this is from the Quran. In order to explain the visions of the murid and unveil his states to him, gradually teaching him the language of the unseen and acting as his teacher and translator. Otherwise, the murid will remain deprived of the knowledge contained in these indications from the unseen world, progress will be unattainable, and knowledge of the stations on the path impossible. The eighth reason is that the wayfarer who journeys on the limited strength of his own foot will be unable in many years to traverse even a single station on the path, for the progress of the novice is less than that of the feeblest ant. Quote, "On this path not every ant can journey, for not every foot is suited to it," end of quote. There are, moreover, certain stations on the path that can be traversed by flying, and the novice is incapable of flying, for he is like an egg that has not reached the station of birdhood. He can reach that station only by a bird exerting influence upon him. The sheikh it is who resembles a bird, and when the murid attaches himself to the wings of his sainthood, he traverses in a brief time on the pinion of the sheikh's aspiration vast distances that he could never have covered himself in whole lifetimes. Through attaching himself to the sheikh, he flies in a realm where he could not fly alone. This feeble one once saw in Kirzam a wayfarer known as Sheikh Abu Bakr. He was from the province of Jam in Khorasan. He was of those whom God had drawn unto himself, and although he had no particular shaykh, by virtue of the rapturous states God had bestowed on him, he had attained lofty stations, passed numerous mighty obstacles, and traversed great distances. While discussing one of the stations with this feeble one, he said, quote, "It took me 45 years of journeying to reach that station, and then, from the rigor of the states accompanying it, my stomach bled for 2 years. I lost much blood, and was about to lose both life and soul when God Almighty caused me to move on from that station." End of quote. This feeble one narrated the story in the presence of his own sheikh, the monarch of the path, the exemplar of the truth, Majid al-Din Baghdadi. May God be well pleased with him. He uttered these blessed words, quote, "None ever recognizes the true value of the sheikh, nor is able to repay the debt that he owes him. We have murids who in 2 years fulfill all the requirements of wayfaring from the beginning of the path to the end of truth. And when they reach that station of which you speak, we cause them to pass beyond it in 1 or 2 days. Yet that venerable one, after 45 years of struggle and being drawn nigh to God, tarries there for 2 whole years and suffers so much pain." End of quote. The ninth reason is that traveling on the path is made possible for the murid by means of zikr, and zikr practiced independently does not yield its full benefit. Rather, it should be received from a perfect sheikh. The tenth reason is that when someone desires at the court of a monarch, in the world of form, to obtain some degree or rank or to acquire some position or governorship, he may not deserve these things or have performed any service that would fit him for them. But when he enters the court in the protection of one of the king's intimates, attaching himself to him, and then submits his request to the royal presence, since the king looks upon that person with favor and accepts his word, he will pay no attention to the lack of merit and prior service of the petitioner, but only to the rights earned by the intimate, to his rank and to his degree of nearness. He will not reject his words, but instead grant his desire, whereas if the petitioner had made his request alone, it would never have been granted. At the court of the true monarch, there are also servants drawn nigh to the presence, whose wish will be granted even if they request that the world be turned on its head. Quote, "Many a dusty and disheveled one clad in rags, to whom men pay no heed, will have his oath fulfilled when he swears upon God." End of quote. Such is the station of those bareheaded, barefooted ones at that court, for they are the kings and monarchs of religion, the guides of the world of certainty. In his presence they enjoy a dignity and esteem that cannot be encompassed in description or statements. Quote, "I have prepared for my righteous servants that which no eye has seen, nor ear has heard, nor has occurred to the heart of any man." End of quote, and this is a hadith Qudsi. There are numerous other reasons for the necessity of a sheikh, but we restrict ourselves to those to avoid length and prolixity. God's peace and blessings be upon Muhammad and all his family.
Thank you.
We live in a world that gives expression to a wide variety of topical themes that are engaged through different academic methodology and frameworks. Such themes range from quantum physics to cosmology, psychology, political science, constitutional law, mythology, evolution, history, mysticism, religion, medicine, education, and literature. For those individuals who are interested in homeschooling their children, in order to provide a context of spirituality through which to study various kinds of subject matter, teaching and exploring the basics of religion might not be enough. Parents should be able to assist their children to explore a very complex and frequently confusing world, but to do so in a way that will not undermine their children's faith. The Sufi Reflections software package consists of 33 books, 4 videos, and an array of poems that give expression to spiritual teachings that provide a very valuable resource for homeschooling activities. Using both non-fictional and fictional means, the Sufi Reflections software package is intended to provide an educational framework through which to engage the complexities of the modern world in a spiritually constructive fashion. For the most part, the material in the Sufi Reflection software package is geared towards a high school level. However, the contents of the software package encompass varying degrees of difficulty, from being fairly elementary to giving expression to more advanced levels of engagement. The contents of the foregoing package provide materials that would be useful for the study of science, religion, political science, law, including Sharia, history, education, literature, mysticism, and more. Moreover, both parents and their teenage children could use the Sufi Reflection software package as a resource to help enhance the quality of homeschooling. If you would like to find out more information about the books contained in the software package, please go to http://anab-whitehouse-menu-menu-1.html. All of the books in the package are individually featured, and a brief description is given for each item. Although I do not have the talent or spiritual stature of Rumi, Hafiz, or even my own spiritual guide, may God be pleased with them all, nevertheless, from time to time, the impetus to write poetry has arisen within me. I have joined such efforts to various musical backgrounds, produced a combination of rhythm, rhyme, and musical overtones that I refer to as floetry, which, in a way, sort of harkens back to the beat generation of the late 1940s and early 1950s, when individuals would recite their poetical compositions against the backdrop of the improvised offerings of a group of jazz musicians that shared the stage with the poet. Some of the poems that will appear in this section of the Sufi Study Circle podcast are inspired by life events of my own, while other poems are rooted in the teachings of great spiritual luminaries of the past. In the latter case, I have run someone else's understanding through the filters of my own limitations, but have tried as best I can to retain the spirit of the ideas and sensibilities that were given expression through the original poems or prose of some great Sufi of the past. This week's floetry section is based on the teachings of Hazrat Abu Sa'id, may Allah be pleased with him. Saints of God are not people who are absent from the world, but will do some of the same things as me and you. Yet there's a sign that serves as a clue to the focus that sets them apart. God's zikr is always in their heart. They know that life's delights are empty in the absence of presence, the key to essential purpose, and they see that if one wishes to be happy, a person must be ready to die, to abandon once without a sigh. Dusty books by which we think we know must be thrown into fires that glow with coals of purity that bestow understanding to which we may go towards the origin of lasting truths that don't depend on rational proofs. Step away from self and retire to a journey that will require you to always seek what is higher than lowly desires which expire when life stops. Exchange things for the friend whose love and compassion do not end. To grasp that one is really nothing is not easy to do, so just sing the praises of God, and this may bring one to one's senses. Yet if we cling to ego's call, our journey may stall before an impenetrable wall. We in our darkness believe we're free to attain to the highest degree of spirituality, to be like gods. In truth, we are just lowly beggars, hoping for droplets of grace so we might know our essential face. We have no right to say I, to feel that actions which come through us reveal that which is real. Surface selves conceal the one true self and place a thick seal over the soul's potential to know, where just waves move by God's undertow. Our intentions towards God are not pure, and such motivations need a cure that can detach them from the allure of delusions that make us so sure we are right when we're totally wrong, mesmerized with the folly of Naf's song. The false self practices its hard sell like a conjurer casting a spell, so that one won't be able to tell the true from the false, and thereby dwell in a state of relativity amidst stations of depravity. The source of all my troubles is me, who believes it is a deity and is deaf to divinity's plea to be open, to listen, to see that God's reality is just one, and only through God do we become. The title of today's edition of Meditative Essays is Murid. On the Sufi path, there is the seeker, Murid, and there is the sought, Murad. Ostensibly, we might suppose we are the seekers and God is the sought, but things are not always what they seem to be. When a person becomes interested in pursuing the mystical path, the individual thinks this idea and interest has come from herself or himself. Perhaps the individual had been reading an article or book on mysticism, which the person came across in some manner or other. Maybe the individual ran into somebody at school or at work who was interested in mysticism. Possibly the person heard about a public lecture on mysticism and decided to go. There are many ways to rationally reconstruct events to have them make sense to us after the fact. Most of the time, all of the little things which had to happen in order to get us to the point where we, for example, saw an article or heard an announcement about a lecture or came into contact with a given individual are lost in the mists of forgotten memory. We do choose, we do have free will, but we also have destiny. Events surrounding our choices are orchestrated. The choices we in reality have are not necessarily as many as we might like to think is the case. We choose events, but events choose us as well. Sometimes the only choice we may have is A, to acquiesce to varying degrees to what is transpiring, or B, to try to resist in some way the way things are unfolding. Indeed, our options even may be limited merely to picking the degree of acquiescence or resistance to events which we cannot avoid. In considering a course of action, many ideas may flitter into and out of consciousness. We assume these ideas are generated by us, but we have no conclusive etiology of the origin of ideas. Modern neurophysiology has brought forth a great deal of evidence linking impaired cognitive functioning with damage to specific brain sites. Nonetheless, no one, neurophysiologists included, has the foggiest notion of how or if neural impulses of bioelectric circuitry or neurotransmitters working individually or in tandem produce ideas or consciousness or reasoning. One can show that by tinkering with the tubes and circuit boards of a television set, one can disrupt the functioning of the set in precise ways. Yet this does not prove the images and sounds made possible by the set originate from within that set. We all know the signals originate elsewhere and are transmitted through the air or through cables to the television. The ideas which arise in our consciousness are not necessarily our own. They may have many different sources, including spiritual ones. Sufi masters indicate God is, in a sense, transmitting signals to us all the time. Some of these messages are in the form of external events. Some of these signals come through our bodies, or our minds, or our emotions, or our hearts. Divinity is calling out to us in diverse ways. From the moment we come into this world, God is trying to get our attention. Hello? Hello? Is anybody at home? More often than not, we are out to lunch or on holiday. When something finally clicks in us, and we become interested in religion, or spirituality, or mysticism, we tend to want to take credit for what is happening. We speak in terms of our search and our seeking. In reality, we have been the sought. God has been the seeker. Why would God seek us? God knows the spiritual potential which is in us. After all, that potential was created and put there by divinity. God, out of pure love, compassion, generosity, and kindness, wishes to share something of divinity with us. God has been seeking us out to apprise us of what is possible. In effect, God is seeking out human beings in at least two senses. First, God is seeking us out in our unredeemed condition of spiritual dissipation. God is calling on us to leave our fallen state of ignorance, darkness, and density, and to return to the knowledge, light, and subtlety of divinity. Secondly, God is seeking out the unique, essential spiritual capacity within us. Only when this capacity is realized do we become fully human. Only when this capacity becomes active do we fulfill the purpose of our potential. If we willingly respond to the divine overture to return to God in a state of spiritual redemption, this is commendable. However, if we willingly respond to God's entreaties and struggle to realize our unique essential potential, this is the best. The Sufi masters take this seeking of us, the sought, by God, the seeker, one step further. According to them, human beings are in essence divine, although we are not divinity in essence. There is both immanence and transcendence in God's relationship with human beings. God is closer to us than life itself, yet God also is entirely independent of us. God's closeness or immanence to us is expressed through the divine character of the potential inherent in our essential spiritual nature. At the same time, God's transcendence is expressed through the distinction drawn between us, even in our essential nature, and the essence of God. Human beings always remain human, even in redeemed and fully realized forms of spirituality. Our capacity to know God is limited by our spiritual capacity. We only know of God what divinity permits. When God seeks us in order to induce us to seek divinity, God is calling us to realize our essential capacity in true identity, which has divinity inherent in it. When we respond to God's call, we take the role of seeker and God becomes the sought. Nonetheless, God becomes the sought in a very special sense. God is being sought in the forms of manifestation which give expression to our unique capacities and essential identity. Consequently, we are seeking the divine within. In effect, we are seeking our own true selves. Ultimately, God is the seeker and God is the sought. However, in a reflected sense, we also are the seeker and the sought. It is all a matter of perspective. To be a true seeker or murid, one has to understand one's responsibility as a potential murad or object which is sought by God. That which divinity is seeking within us is, as indicated in the foregoing, the true self. If we do not seek to realize our essential capacity, we will not be able to worship, love, and serve God in accordance with our spiritual potential. As a result, we will have missed our essential calling in life. We will have failed in our fiduciary responsibilities in relation to the potential which God has entrusted into our care when we were, in a sense, given existence. We must seek our essential uniqueness because this is what God is seeking from us. If, by the grace of God, we realize our true self, then according to Sufi masters, we will come to understand that the seeker and the sought are different manifestations of one and the same reality. The relationship between the initiate and the spiritual guide reflects all of the foregoing. More specifically, if God wishes, an initiate comes to realize in time that the true self of the Sheikh is God's way of inducing the initiate to seek his or her own essential self. One first comes into contact with one's own essential self through the reflection provided by the true self of the Sheikh. By becoming introduced to our true selves through association with the true self of the Sheikh, one comes face to face in reflected form with divine reality. Everything which the Sheikh does with respect to the initiate is a manifestation of God seeking to induce the initiate to realize one truth, namely, the essential capacity of the individual. This is what actually is being sought by God, and therefore, by implication, also by the spiritual guide and the initiate. The following is today's edition of It Has Been Said. Close the doorway of your heart through which otherness enters. Your heart is God's house of worship. Be vigilant with respect to the closing of the doorway of otherness and remain in God's house until you meet divinity. The following segment of the Sufi Studies Circle podcast is a brief prayer that is offered on behalf of whomever might have managed to survive to this portion of the program. O Lord, help us to free ourselves as much as possible from our worldly concerns. Help us to remember that unless knowledge is acted upon, it will depart from us. Help us to understand that there is no peace for a believer except in meeting with Thee. Help us to die to ourselves before we move on from this world. This week's edition of the Sufi Studies Circle podcast has been brought to you by the Interrogative Imperative Institute, where the process of asking questions becomes an artful journey to solutions for life. You have been listening to the Sufi Studies Circle podcast. The host for this program, namely yours truly, is neither a sheikh nor a spiritual guide, nor am I equipped to advise anyone where she or he might be able to formally step onto the Sufi path. When I stumbled into the spiritual tavern of my sheikh, I had no idea what I was doing or how I had found such an establishment. When my sheikh passed away, there were no provisions left in place for anyone else to assume his responsibilities in the future. Since his passing away, I have come to learn, in a very close-up and problematic way, that there are spiritual charlatans who are constantly trolling the waters of existence for vulnerable prey. While I believe there still are authentic spiritual guides who exist in various parts of the world, and unfortunately are becoming fewer in number, I do not have confidence in recommending this or that person as being an authentic shaykh, which is not to say that such people aren't legitimate, but rather it is to say that I do not feel comfortable in recommending them to anyone as individuals for whom I could give assurances that they are people on whom one can rely spiritually. The contents of the program are intended merely as food for thought. While such food might induce someone to want to journey beyond the very limited horizons of the podcast, please keep in mind that I am of the understanding that the Sufi path cannot be traversed without an authentic spiritual guide. And unfortunately, as indicated previously, there are many fraudulent teachers who are actively seeking opportunities to misguide people and thereby not only muddying the spiritual waters, but attempting to corrupt, if not destroy, the spiritual potential of unsuspecting people. Information concerning past editions of the Sufi Study Circle can be found by going to anab-whitehouse.com/circle, that's capital C, small I-R-C-L-E .htm. Thank you for your time, and perhaps we will convene again in the future during some further, God willing, edition of the Sufi Study Circle podcast.